Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the comedian Lee Mack. He writes and stars in the BBC One hit Not Going Out. His stand-up tours do great business, and his lightning-sharp comedy reflexes are also put to good use on a number of prime-time panel shows. He seems like he's just got funny bones, but in reality, he is a grafter. Free association and observational comedy aren't his style. Proper jokes with wordplay and punchlines are. It takes him around 6 weeks to write just one episode of his sitcom. His first ever performance was from on top of a porter cabin, doing impressions for his schoolmates below. But it took him more than 10 years to pluck up the courage to step on stage. Leaving school with 2 O-levels and a cheeky grin, he had a stint as Red Rum's stable boy and a bash at being a professional darts player. Having finally found his way into the nation's living rooms, he says of his comedy career, "I'm the kind of person that, if I don't think it's hard work, I worry that it's not worthwhile. I have to feel as if I have struggled a bit." From the outside, then, all good comedy, I suppose, looks effortless. It is genuinely a struggle for you, is it?
Yeah, I wouldn't say necessarily for me specifically. I think it's a struggle for all comics to write. It's just the writing. I always think the writing is God's way of punishing you for having the best job in the world.
Right.
But it's actually the second best job in the world, because professional footballer is the best job in the world.
That seems like just about the only job you haven't tried.
Yeah, that's true. I should point out, when you say have a go at being a professional darts player, what I used to do was I used to play in my bedroom all the time and then go and play in the local pub darts team. I wasn't very good, and I realised that because in my bedroom there was a bed between me and the board, but in the darts match there wasn't a bed. So my professional career as darts player was cut short because of the inability to bring a bed with you for a darts match.
That would be a problem. These 130 date tours then, and the primetime panel shows that we see you on often, and the sitcom, which of them brings you the most pleasure as a worker?
Well, you see, if you hadn't said the word worker at the end, I'd have said the panel games. Particularly would I lie to you, because we turn up and we just have a bit of fun with it. Because you added the word worker on the end, then I can't say I enjoy that, because there's no work involved. So I get more pleasure out of the sitcom, because it takes so long to write it that it's a sort of labour of love a bit.
What about the demarcation then between Lee MacKillop, which is who you are in your real life on your driving licence and your passport and, you know, forms you fill in for your kids at school, and Lee Mack? Why do you choose to be two different people by name?
Well, it started off, I was actually a mobile DJ many years ago, and I wanted to get a job on the cruise liners. And I thought Lee MacKillop doesn't sound like a name as a DJ and a cruise liner. And by coincidence, my great-granddad was a variety hall comedian called Billy Mack. And so it just seemed logical that I'll just take his name. So I abbreviated it to Lee Mack. But my granddad wasn't happy because I kept the K on it. And Billy Mack, my great-granddad, had just this M-A-C.
Having been a DJ then, is it important to you? I mean, obviously, we're going to get your 8 important tracks today, but is music central to who you are and what you do?
Well, I should point out, when I'm a mobile DJ, it's only as important as getting them on the dance floor with your bubble machine, so I can't claim I was, like, scratching and doing... I had a bubble machine that you had to get specific type of bubbles. It's obviously very slippy, bubbles on the floor, and it was really expensive, this stuff, so I thought, surely you can just use washing up liquid. Mm. And I found out, as a waitress crossed the dance floor with a load of glasses in a tray and went flying up in the air, that's why they don't use fairy liquid in bubble machines.
Let's have some music, Lee Mack. What are we going to hear? What's your first one?
I'm going to go for That's Entertainment by The Jam, because I love The Jam anyway. But when I bought a guitar many years ago, this was one of the first songs I learned to play on it. I should point out, I am as bad at the guitar as I am at darts, but there's not many chords in That's Entertainment, so it's one of the first ones I could strum along to.
Up concrete, a baby wailing, a stray dog howling, the screecher breaks and lamplight blinking. That's entertainment, that's entertainment.
That's The Jam, and That's Entertainment. So Lee Mack, what makes you laugh?
Well, it's a cliched answer, but it is my kids. If my kids find something funny on the telly, that immediately becomes my new favourite show.
Do you make them laugh?
hopefully they would say yes to that answer, but it's always been the thing in my family anyway, that my parents and even my grandparents, that that was the sort of bonding thing, doing gags and messing about. There isn't a photograph of my parents where they haven't got cigarette up the nose or taking their false teeth out.
And that's your mum.
It was.
Yeah, I know.
It really was. My mum had no edit button. That's what I loved about her.
And what about to your wife? Is she your audience at home?
No, she used to be. Like, when I first wrote the sitcom, I'd say to her, can you just listen to me read this script out? And she'd listen to it. And then we had another child, and then it became, well, can you just listen to one script a series? Have you got time for that? Mm. And then it became, we had three children, and now it's, well, can you at least sit down and watch it on the telly when it's broadcast?
I read that you have been diagnosed with ADHD.
Well, when you say diagnosed, in my book, I went to see a psychiatrist, and during those interviews, she said, meeting you, I think there's a very good possibility that you've got ADHD. My wife's not having it. She said, I haven't got it. I just can't multitask. Or the opposite. I'm multitasking too much and thinking of a million things. But, yeah, I don't know if I've got it or not, but it sort of makes sense now that it's been described to me what it is.
One of the most interesting bits about it, I think, because, of course, it's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, is that you also, given this condition, would have the ability to what they call hyperfocus, which is there's only one thing going on. Are you like that?
Well, that's the thing, because I said to the psychiatrist, ah, now you've got the wrong one there, I'm afraid, because I have to focus very much on one thing for a long period of time. She said, that's a classic symptom. And I felt like, whatever I said, you're just going to say that's a classic symptom, aren't you? But it is true, apparently. You see that your mind's all over the place or you're completely focused on one thing. But it's a very beneficial thing in some areas to create ideas. Your mind's flitting all over the place. The biggest symptom for me is when I go to the supermarket and I see all the things on the shelf. It feels like they're literally falling on me. I can't handle that amount of information.
Let's have some music, Lee. We're on your second. Tell me why you've chosen this and what it is.
Well, my dad used to love doing impressions, not professionally, just embarrassing me in front of my friends. He'd always pop out and say, I'm just going to make a cup of tea, and then he'd come back in his underpants and pretend he was Freddie Mercury and hold a broom as the mic. And he would always do Adam Faith. He'd always sing this song. And it sort of got so ingrained in my head. When I wrote Not Going Out, this was the theme music for the pilot, which when we actually did the series, it never made it. But this was the original theme music, and it just reminds me of my dad coming in and going, what do you want if you... Dad, leave it out.
What do you want if you don't want money? What do you want if you don't want gold? Say what you want and I'll give it you, darling. Wish you wanted my love, baby. What do you want if you don't want earning? What do you want if you don't want pearls? Say what you want and I'll give it you, darling. Wish you wanted my love, baby. Well, I'm offering...
Adam Faith and What Do You Want? Tell me more, Lee Mack, about your dad. I think he might have been very good company.
Yeah, he was very good company. That's why they got a pub, I think, because me and my brother Darren grew up in a pub. And I think if you want to be a comedian but you sort of haven't taken the move to become one, next best is to run a pub, I think. And you've got 20 regulars and you can entertain them. And I think that was his attitude. He's a very sociable person, you know.
The family, though, I mean, relatively unusually, had a theatrical background. As you say, was it your great-grandfather?
It was my great-grandfather. Right. But it wasn't until I started doing stand-up that my gran said, oh, your great-granddad was a variety. And she gave me some pictures of him. One was where he's dressed as in a drag act thing or dressed as an old woman. And another one where he's dressed as a toff. And then there's another picture that there's only bit of evidence I've got of what he used to actually do on stage, which says, come and hear Billy Mack sing his amusing song about cabbages, car beans and carrots.
Right. But your father then thought it wasn't for him, but he had this sort of ebullient personality that liked a bit of attention.
Yeah. I was very proud of the fact that when I was about 19 or 20, I knew that if I brought my mates to go and see my dad, he would be more like them than a dad. So he was always a bit more like a degenerate older brother.
Yes.
And I already had one of them, so I didn't need another.
Yes, do you know what? That's a great line, and it is really funny, but it's also true that you don't really need your parents to be your friends, because you have friends and you have siblings. Were there times when you wished he was a bit more like a dad?
I suppose so. I mean, my mum and dad split when I was quite young, so I was only sort of 11 or 12 when he sort of left home, so I went to visit him regularly over the years from that age.
You were on holiday when they actually physically broke up?
Yes. There used to be a thing called Pontinental, which was Pontins on the continent.
Is that true?
It really was. And it was seen as the slightly upmarket Pontins. So we thought, yeah, we'll do that. We own a pub. Yeah, we've got a bit of money. We'll go Pontinental now. And four of us went and three of us came back. Because when we were out there, my dad, I think the pressures of the pub and also their own personal problems just came to a head at that point. And on the last night, he went off. He says, I can't handle it. So he went. As is always the case in our family, it would have been quite comical. I know it sounds terrible, but my mum said, Your dad's had a few drinks and he's probably lying by the pool. Go and find him. We've got to get on the coach in a minute. So we had to go and look for him. And then it became like, he's not by the pool. Well, have a look on the beach. He's not on the beach. So we had to fly back without him. But there was a real sense of, oh, he'll get on the next plane. But no, he stayed away.
And was there a degree of chaos in the house? Was it a household where things were a bit chaotic?
Totally. You know, we had quite a wild upbringing looking back. My mum and dad let us do things that I would never dream of letting my kids do.
Like what?
Well, in the old days, pubs used to close in the afternoon at like 2 or 3 o'clock, didn't they? And then open up again at 6. But some of the regulars were allowed to sort of stay around as an afternoon look-in. And they would do seances and things. But yeah, it was just sort of that slightly chaotic, drunken 70s way of being. I just thought everyone was brought up. I thought everyone in the world was having lock-ins and doing seances.
Let's have some music now, then, Mike.
Yes. Now, this is the first single I ever bought. Right. So I'll have been about 13. And it was 79p from Woolworths. I remember saving up in the days when you saved up for things. And I bought the single and it went immediately out of my hand and flew under the Space Invader machine. And the woman said, we have to buy another one. I said, well, I haven't left the shop yet. And I remember that thing about, you know, if you shoplift, you can't be accused of shoplifting till you've left the shop. This isn't a tip. I'm not giving advice to the kids if they're listening. So I quoted that. I said, so if that's the case, then surely if I've not left the shop, I've not bought it. She just looked at me blankly and said, do you want to buy another one or not? And so in the end, I did. I had to go home, I had to save up again and buy this single again. So, it's Adam and the Ants. Now, the first thing was Stand and Deliver, but even I haven't got the confidence to come on Desert Island Discs and play Stand and Deliver as one of my top eight. So instead, I'm going to play the much cooler, punky B-side, Beat My Guess.
Adam and the Ants and Beat My Guess. So, Lee Mack, your parents broke up and that meant that you moved back to Southport. Having had sort of lots of different homes when your parents had lots of different pubs, do you think that made an impression on you, moving around so much?
Oh, without a doubt. I worked out, I think, by the age of 18, I'd lived in 16 different houses.
Wow.
We were moving all the time.
And so changing schools a lot as well. Some people do find that a problem and other people just sort of...
Yeah, well, I think that was probably my way into comedy, really, because I went to another school and I had a very strong Lancastrian accent. And in Southport, it's a very soft accent in terms of... It's not a strong Lancashire accent. And they used to say this. You sound like Bobby Ball from Cannon and Ball. So... trying to ingratiate myself with my new friends, I thought, well, I'll play on that and do impressions of Bobby Ball. So that's what I did. I had all the catchphrases, rock on, Tommy, you've got me skin. I was even going to get a perm and grow a moustache, but my dad genuinely had got that. So I thought, don't look too much like your dad at that age, dear. Plus, I couldn't grow a moustache at 30.
What was making you laugh at 13, apart from Cannon and Ball? The Young Ones and that
stuff? The Young Ones and Saturday Night Live and, you know, the comic strip. All the stuff that... It was the sort of comedy equivalent of punk and... I was fascinated by it. I thought it was absolutely amazing.
What about 70s comedy, though? I mean, were you watching things like Rising Damp? Were you watching Morecambe and Wise? Ronnie's Porridge?
Absolutely. My appreciation of all that kind of stuff, I think, has come later on, though. I mean, I remember liking them, but I didn't. It wasn't a life-changing thing for me. I didn't watch that and go, one day I want to be a comedian. It wasn't any of that. It wasn't until 1980 and alternative comedy started that got me interested in thinking, I would like to do this one day.
Being a jockey then, were you a keen rider?
Not at all. I was thrown out of college at 16 because I'd failed all my O-levels and then I went back to resit my O-levels and lasted like 6 weeks until I realised I was still just a kid who was messing about at school, so I left. And I went home thinking, well, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? And I put the telly on as I was thinking it and horse racing was on. And I'd had a mild interest in it because my granddad liked to bet. I used to watch the Grand National, but that was it. But I thought, well, I could just turn up at 16, right, if I'm small and skinny, which I was.
Had you even been on a horse?
Never. I'd been on, like, Blackpool Beach on a donkey, and I think I'd been on pony trekking rides in Spain. But I'd not had any horse history whatsoever. But, by coincidence, in my hometown, they trained Red Rum, and he was still alive. So I thought, well, I'll do that then. So having turned the telly on to phoning up the stables was probably about 60 seconds. And I said, yeah, I'm thinking of becoming a jockey. Do you need anyone?
So did you actually ride horses at the stables as well as mucking out?
Well, funny enough, the first horse I ever rode was Red Rum. He'd retired and he was just, you know, he'd go around, he'd open betting shops and supermarkets and things. And my mate said to me at the time he was working there, he said, right, it's about time you sat on a horse I said, all right. So I jumped on a horse. And he said, you know who that is, don't you? And I hadn't sort of, they all looked the same to me. He went, that's Red Rum. I went, oh. So I thought, that's amazing. First horse I ever rode was Red Rum. I wish I'd got a photo. That's the only thing I should have done, was got the photo. So my job was to occasionally take them for walks. So I'd take him for a walk round the roads and took him to my gran's house and knocked on the door, went, you're not going to believe who this is. She went, who? I went, it's Red Rum. She went, I don't care who it is, get him off my lawn. No interest at all, just get him off my lawn. I thought she'd be like, it's Red Rum. Couldn't care less.
Do you enjoy it?
I hated it. I don't know why. I realised within an hour of being there that I was terrified of horses. But I thought, well, what am I going to do if I don't do this? This is my new career, isn't it? I thought, I'll learn to like them. But as soon as they sat me on a horse, I was like, these are quite high up. And, you know, racehorses are really big. You know, it's terrifying. Absolutely terrifying.
Let's have some music, Lee Mack. We're on your fourth.
Yes. Now, when I was a kid, because I've got a slightly obsessive nature, my mate introduced me to Queen, the band, not the monarch. And I liked the album he played with. So I thought, right, well, I'll buy a record player. So I bought the album and the record player. So I now own one album and one record player. And thought, well, I'll go and buy another album now. I thought, well, don't mess with the system. You like that, buy another Queen album. And in the end, I had about 12 or 13 Queen albums, but nothing else. So it would feel right that I have to choose one of my 13 Queen albums from all those years ago. And also, I suppose, given that the nature of sitcom writing, I'm under pressure. Is that all right to do an Alan Partridge
thing? I see what you did there.
Yeah, so that's why I chose this one.
That was Queen with David Bowie and Under Pressure. So, Lee Mack, you did go on at one point, among the variety of pretty unusual jobs that you had, to be a Pontins bluecoat. Did that feel like it was on the way to something that might approximate to showbiz?
Well, people have said to me, oh, so that was your way in, was it? You became a bluecoat. Couldn't be further from the truth. The decision to become a jockey was about 60 seconds. The decision to become a bluecoat was even quicker. I was working in a bingo hall. There was a guy there that decided to get an entertainment agency going. I just popped in to see how he was getting on into his office. He was on the phone, chat, chat, chat. He put the phone to one side and went, do you want to be a bluecoat at Pontins? I went, yeah, all right. And that was it. I went for the interview. I thought, that sounds fun. I'll just do that.
What were your duties?
Well, my friend also joined me, Saul. We were the ones that couldn't perform.
You weren't allowed to, or you weren't able to?
We couldn't do anything. We had no skills. These kids were all 17, 18. They were dancers, singers, sort of showbiz wannabes. And me and my mate, I'd gone to be the sports organiser.
Right.
His speciality was to dance with old people. And the rest were all... So on the Friday night Bluecoat show, they'd all perform. And me and my mate had to stand at the back and hold a big American flag and wave it, because that's the only skill we had. And then the flags didn't turn up, so we had to wave. It was very undignified.
Did you watch them and think,
yeah,
I could do better than that?
I mean, I'd obviously, at this point, this was 1988, so the alternative comedy revolution had happened. And so it did feel a little bit dated at the time, what they were doing. And it was my first go at stand-up comedy, because the host of the night, the entertainment manager, said, I don't want to run tonight's show. Will you host it? And I'd done a bit of mic work as a blue coat. I'd done a bit of hello, welcome to the Knobbly Knees competition type thing. But I'd never actually done comedy. And so I thought, right, I'll give it a crack. I've always wanted to do it, but I didn't have any material. So I did what all the other comics did at Pontins and just did a bit of their act. You know, they're all shirring it round. And I can't tell the story on this lovely radio show, but it involved me swearing at the audience and being sacked. So I was on the next train back up north. But they gave me my job back, but I had to go to Morecambe.
You have got a touch of the Eric Morecambes about you, I think.
Have I?
I think so.
I always thought you've had a touch of the Ernie Wises, so we make a good couple.
Way! Let's have some music.
Okay, so the next one is Joy Division. I've always been a bit obsessed with Ian Curtis, but the reason I've chosen this particular song, Atmosphere, is because I've trained for the marathon a couple of years ago. And I used to listen to this song a lot when I was training for the marathon, which is the most unrunning-friendly song you could get. It's slow and it's miserable. But to me, that was part of the struggle. I thought, if I'm having a miserable time when I'm training for the running, that's almost romanticised the effort. Do you see what I mean?
I do.
Always danger.
Joy Division and Atmosphere. So you say you were training for the marathon when you listened to this. Did you actually, you ran the marathon then?
No, I didn't. I got to about 13 or 14 miles in the training and I got severe pain in my leg and I went to see the doctor and he said, you can't run because your legs are different lengths. So I had to end my marathon career there. And I have to say it was one of the greatest bits of news I'd ever been given because now I had the get out clause. I can't run the marathon. I was hating it. It's just that somehow I'd set myself a goal.
So there came a time then, Lee Mack, where you decided you wanted to move to London.
Yes. Well, I'd visited and I was walking around with a mate, just split up with my girlfriend at the time and just not knowing what I was doing in my life. And I just wandered into the Comedy Store, not really knowing what it was. I recognised a few faces on the wall from Friday Night Live and stuff, but I didn't know what it was about. And it really was like for want of a better phrase, it was a life-changing moment. I thought, yes, this is incredible, I want to do this. But I was convinced, to get up on stage and be that funny, you have to be have no insecurities, you have to know everything about life. They were almost like mythological creatures in my head. I thought, I want to be like those kind of people. Yes. So what I'll do is I'll travel the world and become worldly wise.
Yes.
So I did. I got as far as Australia for a year. Right. I thought, right, I've had enough of this travelling the world malarkey. I'll go back home and I'll do stand-up comedy. But I still didn't have the guts to do it. So I thought university is the nearest thing to a world of performing. If I can do some sort of drama or film or television degree, which is what I did, drama, film and TV, that was the nearest thing on the list to stand-up comedy.
I can't imagine doing your drama degree at Brunel University that you did much stand-up. Were you in a unitard pretending to be a
tree?
There
was a little bit of dressing in black and rubbing walls. But actually, Brunel massively helped me because what they did was they said, do what you want. If you want to run a comedy club at the university, we'll count it towards your degree. So I did a module in stand-up comedy. I ran it. I booked the acts, put my own money into it, I put the posters on the wall and brought in people from the circuit to perform. And then I was the MC.
It was also very important because it was the time that you met the woman who would go on to become your wife. When did you tell Tara that you wanted to be a stand-up?
I'd never told anybody, really. I'd kept this. It was like a dirty little secret I never told anyone about. And I was plucking up the courage. We got together and I thought, I've got to tell this person. So I said, look, the thing is, I want to be a stand-up comedian. She went, oh, yeah, good idea, you should do that. Very casually, didn't think anything of it. I'd spent 10 years harbouring because it sounds silly now, though, but honestly, in the early 90s, I mean, no one wanted to be a comedian. There wasn't that many comics around. But at the time, it was a bit nerve-wracking in case you went, you can't do that, you're not funny.
Let's have some music.
As you said earlier, I did a 130-night tour, and I don't know what it is. Maybe it's to do with this ADHD. But after every gig, I listened to this song.
Every gig?
Every night. I have to wear the same suit on stage. I should point out I wear a different shirt because they get quite sweaty. But I don't like to think. So first night, the road manager said, what would you like to dinner? And I said, I'll have spaghetti bolognese. So the next night, he said, what do you want for dinner? And I thought, well, that worked, so I'll have that again. And then the third night, I thought, this show's going well. I'll don't break it. I'll have the spaghetti bolognese. So I had spaghetti bolognese every night for 130 nights on tour. I'd wear the same suit. And when I come off stage, I'd always listen to the same song as the sort of I'm winding down after the gig music. I like things to be exactly the same. Very rock and roll, isn't it? Comedy. Spag bol on the same song every night.
Are you aching for the blade? That's okay. We're insured. Are you aching for the grave? That's okay. We're insured. We're getting away with it all, mister. Getting away with it all, mister. That's the living.
That was James and Getting Away With It All. So, Lee Mack, it must, of course, be the case that it is your significant presence on TV now that drives the people who buy the tickets to come see you when you do these big stand-up tours. Do you think people are ever surprised that the person that they see on television, who is a more sort of gentle, family-viewing character, can really get pretty edgy?
I get a bit worried about it, that's the truth. I mean, I started off as a stand-up comedian and still see myself as one. And then I had a little sidestep into a sitcom, Panel Games, where obviously the nature of TV is you tone it down, or you don't tone it down, but you're edited in a way that looks like you've toned it down. Then you go back out on tour and you look down, you suddenly see a man and a wife and their two children sat in the front row and you go, you haven't seen me do live stuff before, have you? You get worried that they don't know what to expect. And so I always make it absolutely clear on the posters, you know, this, there will be some bad language, and if you don't want to come, I understand, so please keep away.
And what about the thorny issue of women in comedy? You do all these panel shows, and the current mood right now is that, well, why are there not more women on panel shows? You know, we turn on our televisions, yeah, and there are six guys sitting there, and sometimes there are five guys and a woman. Sometimes, not very often, there are two women.
You're right. Well, I'm glad you asked me this question, because I actually, during my drama, film and television degree, I did a thesis on women in comedy. And for me, what I think is, the problem isn't that there's not enough women in panel games. The problem is there's not enough women in comedy in general. If 20% of comedians out there are female, then it makes sense that 20% of people on panel games are female. And the conclusion that my thesis, and this is people who have, I'm only quoting other scientific reports on it, mm-hmm, is that when men sit around together and talk, they're very competitive. One person will tell an anecdote, then the next person will try and top that with another anecdote. When you get six women in a room together, they share a lot more. They'll be far more interested in what the other person has to say. So the conversation is broken up a lot more, and it's more interactive and less about individually showing off. So obviously when you start doing stand-up, if you've been trained in showing off because you're a bloke, it's going to be more conducive to your style of humour. So it's actually a compliment, I think, to women that there aren't as many female stand-ups, because they're far more interested in what each other has to say than standing there on their own and showing off. But it does mean there's probably less of them starting in the first place.
Do you think it might also... I mean, obviously, we know women can be funny. Women have been funny since Lucille Ball on telly and onwards. Do you think it's maybe got something to do with the construct of a panel show that allows men to do what they do and feel comfortable and doesn't allow women to go on and be funny and do what they do and feel comfortable?
It depends on the panel game. I think that if a panel game is based around doing your bit of material, doing your stick, then, yeah, it's more conducive to blokes who like showing off. If it's about interacting, which I hope that we do on Would I Lie To You, because it's a game, then it's more about actually talking to the person, listening to what they have to say, and less about you individually doing your bit of material. But then you could ask the question, why is there more men on Would I Lie To You? And I'd have to give you my producer's email address. So can we move on before I get into trouble?
Let's have some music. Okay, we are on your seventh disc of the morning, Lee Mack. What are we going to hear?
Now, I'm going to do something maverick for this show. I've chosen a song that I really don't like.
Oof.
This song is Now That We've Found Love by Third World. And I used to like it, but the reason I've chosen it is because we've had three children, and for some reason, this is the song that gets my children asleep when they're young and they're babies. And so this song has been played in my car or in my house, sometimes up to 30 times a day, for all three kids. And I'm now sick to death of this song. I can't tell you how sick to death I am, but my theory was, if I'm on a desert island on my own, then I'd miss my kids, and this would remind me of the kids. So I will love it again when I'm on the island, but for now, can't stand it.
Shook all over the place. I say, come on, baby, when the music's playing, I wanna see you dance, dance, dance. Come on, baby, say when the music's playing.
That was Third World, and Now That We've Found Love. Did you mentally have a little baby on your shoulder?
I can almost smell the baby sick.
Nice.
Yeah.
Tell me about your parents then. Your parents now are both passed away. Live to see any of your success as a stand-up?
Yeah, they both lived long enough so that I'd already started doing a bit of telly. Not much, but a little bit. So they were aware that, you know, I was going to make some money out of it. So at least I had a job.
And your father, who we know, as you say, sort of maybe somewhere deep inside had something of the performer in him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he would absolutely love it. He lived longer than my mum, so he saw even more of my telly work.
Did he come along and watch?
Oh, God, no, I couldn't. I'd be too... Like I say, that would be too odd, having your family there. I've had it happen. It's so stressful. The extra pressure of having family members in there, because they know Lee McKillop rather than Lee Max. You know, it feels like the wrong relationship for me. So that's why they have to sit right at the back. And if I know anyone in the front row, oh, forget it. Hate it.
What happens? Do you lose your bottle?
It's not that I lose my bottle. When I say game over, don't get me wrong, if you come to one of my tour dates,
you'll still do
and
it.
Someone I know is in the front row, I won't just go, forget it, and walk off stage. But I don't know why. I just have two versions of my life. I have the version where I'm at home and I'm the normal person. Then I have the version that works in telly and does stand-up tours. And so I don't like the crossover of those two things. I like to keep them separate.
No audience, of course, on the desert island. How do you feel about being on your own?
How do I feel about being on my own? I think I like being on my own. I've got my wife and children always around me, so what does that feel like? When you've got three kids, the feeling of being on your own, just I forgot that memory. How does that work?
And are you, your comedy persona is that of the sort of mild buffoon. On this island, would you be able to lash up a shelter some fish? And
in my first flat, I built a pair of shutters, and that really impressed the wife.
Did you?
Proper shutters on the window.
Did you?
And then I drove past the house recently, they'd taken them down. Yeah, I'm quite practical. I've built a shed.
Have you?
Well, I paid a man to build a shed, but I ordered it from eBay. I mean, wanting a shed means you're practical, right?
Not really.
No?
Time for your final piece of music, then. Tell me about this.
Well, this was supposed to be the House Martins, because the album that's followed me around all my life is London Nil Hull 4 by the House Martins. And as I was working out which track, my wife said, "Which song are you playing for me?" And in the panic, I said, "Van Morrison! our wedding song, love." So this is the song that... Because my wife has definitely given me a better taste in music. So I would never admit that to her face, but seeing as we're on the radio, I'll say it. She's introduced me to Van Morrison. I didn't really know much about him before we got together. I made our wedding video. I edited it, and I put this on because it's my wife's... one of my wife's favourite songs, so this is for Tara.
If I ventured in the slipstream between the viaducts of your dream, where mobile steel rims crack and the ditch in the back road stop, could you find me? Or would you kiss my eyes, laying me down, silence easy to be born again?
Van Morrison and Astral Weeks. So I'm going to give you the books now, Lee Mack. I give you the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, and you get to take another book to the island. What else would you like to take?
Well, I'm going to take A Brief History of Time, Stephen Hawking, because I haven't read it, so I figure the number one rule is take a book you haven't read. And my theory is you'd be lying around all day thinking, well, I don't know how I ended up here. And it'll start making you think, well, how did any of us end up here? But I'm glad you get the Bible, because I would read the Bible. I think it's quite odd that people like myself, in their 40s, quite happy to dismiss the Bible, but have never read it. I always think if an alien came down and you were the only person they met and they said, what's life about? What's Earth about? How? Tell us everything. And you said, well, there's a book here that purports to tell you everything. Some people believe it to be true. Some people not believe it true. Wow, what's it like? And you go, oh, I don't know, I haven't read it. It would be an odd thing, wouldn't it? So at the very least, read it. So I could read that, and then I could read Stephen Hawking, and I'd have hours to make my decision.
And the Shakespeare as well.
And I won't bother with that.
You're allowed a luxury too.
Well, I want to go for coffee. I'm very addicted to coffee. But my wife said, you can't say coffee because Kirsty won't let you have a coffee and a plunger.
No, I would.
Oh?
Yeah.
And milk?
Yes.
And a fridge to put the milk in?
Yes.
Can I take the whole kitchen?
No.
Because the juice is quite handy as well with all that fruit.
No, I will give you the accoutrement to make nice coffee every morning.
That will do me. So, so I'll take coffee, lots of milk, the machine that comes with it, the fridge to put the milk in, teaspoon, I'm not using my finger.
Pushing it now.
All right.
And if you had to save just one track from the eight, which one would you save?
Van Morrison, I Love My Wife Very Much.
It's yours, Lee Mack. Thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.